Most of this series has been politically incorrect, and tonight will not disappoint you. There's no exception to it tonight. That is, because our society's intellectuals, who determine what is politically correct and what is not politically correct, are consistently portrayed as heading away from Christianity into the abyss of atheism, the media spin is not actually telling the truth when you check out the actual leadership of our society. Many of them are heading towards Christianity, but that's not actually part of the media myth. But there is enough truth in the media myth that the public discourse doesn't allow Christian thinking even an opportunity to speak or to intrude. And so when you come inside a Christian church and I say the things I'm going to say, you'll hear words and ideas and values that you'll find are actually quite different to what you hear every day. Well, that's why you come to church, to hear something that is quite different. Try and say it outside and you'll find how difficult it is to be a Christian in this world. But more of that in a little moment. If we are to be Christians, we need to work out the source of our values. I read a book some years ago called Guidance and the Voice of God, which I understand we haven't got on sale at the moment in the bookshop, but we will get in due time. Guidance and the Voice of God asks the question, where do you get your guidance from? All Christians say from the Bible, until you actually start pointing out what the Bible says, and then suddenly, well, do I really get my guidance from the Bible? There was a wonderful book written many years ago now, about the 60s I think, called The Christian Mind by a man called Harry Blamires, B-L-A-M-I-R-E-S, Blamires, an Englishman. If you ever see it in a second-hand bookshop, grab hold of it. It's a fascinating book at exposing how our thinking is not as Christian as we think it is. In fact, our thinking is the way the world thinks, which we just lightly put a Christian gloss over the top of. And it's particularly difficult for those of us who have grown up in a Christianized culture, because the culture itself doesn't understand what Christian is and what Christian's not and where it's got its values from. And many of our values, for example, monogamy, comes out of our Christianity. But our society doesn't understand that it comes from our Christianity and just assumes that monogamy is the way of life, and it is a real and obvious and only way to have our society run. Until, of course, we bring enough Muslims into our society who insist on polygamy, and in the next generation you will see the argument for polygamy in Australia, which hasn't been aired for the 200 years of white settlement that is here, because we move away from Christianity, and so we move to a different kind of society. We tend to think, as our society around us thinks, that the way of normality is the way we live. And where do we get our sense of normality? Well, it comes on the subject of marriage and family life, most importantly from our own parents. Even from those of us who come from unhappy homes, we still identify what should be, shouldn't be, in light of what mum and dad did or didn't do. And if our home is really miserable, then we say, well, it's never going to be like that, whatever else. But we still identify what marriage is by the bad things that we have seen, or the good things that we have seen if we've come from a happy home. And then you add in your friends and your peers and see other homes, and their values are mediated to us through our education system and through public media, TV, radio, newspaper, and from the films we watch and from the art we view and from the plays and the novels. And so we create a view of what married life, what family life should be about, is about, and what our married life, our family life should or shouldn't be about. And it becomes a normal way of thinking, which often we haven't sat down and done what we're doing tonight, that is to actually ask the fundamental questions as to what it is all about. See, some attitudes of our society, our culture, are patently absurd, like women wearing stilettos, or men wearing suits and ties in an Australian summer. It is the culture, it is what is done, but it's mad. But fashion end of culture is the most volatile, fast-changing end of the culture, isn't it? Many aspects of our broader culture continue on because they are effective ways for a large number of people to live together in some degree of harmony and unity, justice and peace in a land together. But as our society swings away from Christianity, so those of us who want to name the name of Jesus as our Lord and Saviour are increasingly swimming against the tide. And as this increases, so your sense of isolation, alienation, your sense of not fitting, not being at home in your own homeland will increase. Now, for some temperaments, that's not a problem. We're not easily swayed by fashion or popularity. We've never been popular. We've never been fashionable. So it's just the way we've grown up. If you're a committed lifelong nerd, what's the difference? You know, no one ever did like you, so why are you expecting anybody to like you in the future? And so it's easier for those of us who have failed consistently in life to keep failing. But for others who are less personally secure, or who grew up in tune with our culture and popularity, then the sudden departure from our roots, or the need to feel part of something bigger, or the need to just feel kind of normal like everybody else, is a powerful coercive force that makes it harder and harder to accept and live by Christian values. Sometimes we've so Christianized the cultural values around about us that we don't recognize how worldly we are, and how out of step with the gospel we really have become. I think you notice it on materialism and on consumerism more than you notice on marriage and family life. But in due time, our capacity for Christianising the non-Christian world's view is slowly overtaking us. Divorce is becoming more common within the Christian community. That was not so in a previous generation. And the question of diversity within marriage that we're going to be looking at in a few moments' time is certainly not now taught in Christian churches as it was in previous generations, for the world's view of no diversity within the marriage is becoming more normative, even amongst Christians. Sometimes, of course, we're so desperately trying to be like the world in order to win the world that we forget that we are supposed to be different in order to win the world to something that's different. If you are so much like the world that you win the world to be like the world, you haven't won the world at all. The world has won you. Often the problem is at just a basic assumption level. We assume that what we were doing was right or wrong. It's what our parents did. It's what everybody else did. Not actually knowing what God wants from us or what he has told us in his word. Now, nowhere is all this truer than the issue of male-female relationships. For God made us to share humanity, and when he created us, he didn't make us as androgynous humans, sexless beings, from which he later divided us. Adam was Adam before Eve was taken from him. And Adam was Adam after Eve was taken from him. It's not as if he suddenly became a different kind of creature now that Eve had been taken from him. He was the man beforehand, he was the man afterwards. She was never the man, she was always the woman. For in Genesis 1, he created us male and female, fully human in his image. So it's not that I am a person who happens to be a male. I am a male person. My maleness is not some kind of add-on given to me as a kind of gender construction by my patriarchal culture. My maleness is part and parcel of who I am as a person. It's written into every cell of my body. You cannot be, and you cannot know me as a person. You can only know me as a man, for that's what I am. I'm not a person, I'm a man. And you are either a man or a woman. There is that clear binary nature of humanity. And so our femaleness is not a kind of gender construct of society. It's your very person, your very self. It's who you are and who God created you to be. If he'd wanted you to be a man, my sisters, he would have created you as a man. He's quite capable of doing it. He wanted you to be a woman, and so he has created you as a woman. And between males and females, there are absolute differences, relative differences, and shifting relativities. You see that in my outline that most of you, I don't see, are looking down and taking notes to, so I'll just draw your attention to, that I'm actually up to point 2 and points A, B and C under point 2. There'll be a long time before we get to the Bible passages, so at least keep taking the notes. Firstly then, there are absolute differences between man and woman. These are parts of creation, and the most important part of them is that they are God-intended and desired. It's God who made us male and female. It's God who made the woman for the man. And if it is God who did it, then we must accept with joy and contentment the way we have been made. So what are these absolute differences that he made? Well, they have to do with two things. Firstly, the nature of our bodies, and secondly, the purposes of God. Firstly, then, the nature of our bodies. And the bodily differences the absolute ones have to do with reproduction. Man, we're told in 1 Corinthians 11, is now born of woman, and all things are from God. But woman is not born from man. Men do not bear babies, nor do they breastfeed them. In consequence, there are a range of anatomical differences between all men and all women, and it is absolute. You are or one or the other. Now, I know that some will come with those terribly sad medical occasions in which there is some confusion between them. And they are indeed very sad, extraordinarily sad. And the ones that I have dealt with myself, they are some of the most unhappy people that I have ever met because of the difficulties of living in a world which is binary when they are so confused as to which they are. Because basically, fundamentally, men are men and women are women, bodily. Secondly, God has also appointed men and women. It's a difference. That is, both are appointed to be fruitful, fill the earth and multiply. Both are appointed to subdue the earth and have dominion over it as a united humanity. But man was placed in the garden to till it and to care for it, and the woman was created to be his helper in a way that no animal could be, for no animal could be united with the man, leaving the family to create a new family. And so the New Testament says in 1 Corinthians 11 that he was not made for her, but she was made for him. And so woman is the glory of man. But I'm going over old territories. From these, there are a number of relative differences. There are many differences between men and women that are not essentially about reproduction. By and large, men have less hair growing out of the top of their heads and more growing out of their chin, or in November, their upper lip. By and large, men's voices are lower than women's voices. I call these a relative difference because it's not fundamental to being a man or a woman. A man with a high voice is still a man, and a woman with a low voice is still a woman. It's also relative because it's not universally true. There are many exceptions. There are bald, bearded ladies. And the variations between us range over a whole thing. Men are by and large taller than women. But there are many women who are taller than many men. But it still does not stop the generality that is true that men are taller than women. There is no agreement on the level of all these relative differences, or whether they're innate or learnt in many occasions, or evolved and actually been produced in us by our selective breeding programs. So some of the most contentious debates are about our brains and the way in which we think process information and talk with each other. How much of this is nurture? How much of this is nature? And whether we're describing the differences accurately, and it's all very difficult to determine. Some years ago I read a book by Anne Moyer and David Jessel, non-Christian book called Brain Sex. One's a biochemist, the other's a journalist, and so the journalist made the biochemistry simple for us lay folk. And it reviewed the research on men and women and brain structure and brain function and came to the conclusion that there is actually a huge difference between men and women in our brains. And so it gave this phrase, brain sex. And they argued, especially, for example, from the effect of testosterone, that there are significant differences in the ways in which males develop intellectually as opposed to the way in which women develop intellectually. Testosterone makes not only a difference in thinking process, but also makes differences in levels of aggression. And as you keep pushing on this kind of research in popular levels, so you wind up with John Gray and men are from Mars and women from Venus. But Christian behaviour is not determined by chemistry. You may be more aggressive than your sisters, but that gives you absolutely no right to be aggressive. It just means you have to work harder against your aggression than your sisters. You may need to learn how to control your aggression more than your sisters. Indeed, you may really have to work on the subject of aggression, my brothers, because you have a problem with it in a way that your sisters don't. But whether you do or do not have more aggression because of your chemistry is a complete irrelevance to your Christian behaviour, even if it can be shown to be true. Now, these relative differences are not essential to being male or female. You can be a very aggressive woman. I hope you're not, but you can be. If you are, please don't tell me about it later and don't come up to me and make sure I understand. I know it's possible you can be a very aggressive woman. I have met one or two in my life. You can also be a very passive man. But that doesn't make you not a woman because you're aggressive or not a man because you're passive. And there are differences within each sex which may be larger than the differences between the sexes. Yet there remains a consistent pattern of differences. And it's not only one issue, hair out the top of the head, or one or two issues, hair and the way we think and aggression levels. It's over hundreds and hundreds of issues that there develops two populations within humanity. Two populations that are distinctive and can be seen as distinctive. And from the weight of our bodies down to the comparative size of our index finger and our ring finger, there are hundreds and hundreds of differences between men and women that combined give us a sense of gender, which most cultures then underline and magnify, for example, in terms of the importance of hairstyling for women and the short hair for men. Is a pattern across the world and across the cultures, but it is part of exhibiting femininity or exhibiting masculinity. And so there is a construction of what is masculinity and what is femininity that comes from our cultures grabbing hold of the differences of the two populations and pushing them further, highlighting them, illustrating, demonstrating them. But these cultural underlinings, magnifyings, are part of the shifting relativities between men and women. But there comes a time when our culture becomes too rigid in what men and women should or shouldn't do, could or couldn't do, can and cannot do. And rigid stereotypes of males and female roles are insisted upon and become limiting for both males and females. Over time, these, of course, are challenged, and people discover that women can run long-distance races and marathons and play soccer and basketball and rugby. Although I confess to the couple of times I've watched women playing rugby, I wish they wouldn't. However, if they want to, they can. It's just not much of a spectacle. And for some bizarre reason, We still at Wimbledon don't have five set tennis games for women. I can't quite work that one out, seeing women get bigger prize money at the end of only playing three sets. But hey, there must be an explanation somewhere. Now, these relativities have come into more significance in the area of men and women and marriage of recent times with the push of feminism. The latter half of the 20th century was socially and culturally about this issue, where there was a great encouragement to women that they can do whatever they like to do. They do not need a man any more than a fish needs a bicycle, which was a phrase apparently originally written on the toilet door at the University of Sydney, of all places, by a woman called Irina Dunn. It was attributed to Gloria. This is just a little piece of miscellaneous information I found out in the last week as I was reading. I mean, if you get this kind of miscellaneous information, you can't use it very often, so you get it, don't you? But it was always said to be Gloria Steinem, but she agrees, no, it was Irina Dunn who actually invented the phrase, coming out of it. Never mind. She was doing an arts degree at the University of Sydney, which is a very fine thing to do. And a fish needs a bicycle. So does a woman need a man. You can be what you want to be without a man. You can do what you want to do. Anything a woman wants to do, she can do. But how far can we, should we go along this line? A woman Prime Minister? A woman Governor General? A woman High Court Judge? Well, these ideas no longer shock anybody or amaze anybody, though they may have well shocked and amazed a previous generation. But should 50% of senior executives be women? Should 50% of politicians be women? Should 50% of... Should we take affirmative action to make sure that women have exactly the same role in society as men? And if that's the case, what about the role of wife and mother? Is that now an unacceptable role for a woman to follow? Here is the real tension point. The tension point that is running through our society, the barbecue stopper, as they call it, the tension between work and family, especially as it relates to wives and mothers. And the issue of childcare, the issue of whether we put children into preschools and at what age and for how long and... Only at the beginning of this month, November the 1st, I think it was, in the London paper, the Sunday Times, there was an article on being a good wife. I read a little bit of it to you. Are you a good wife? There's something awkward about this question in the first decade of the 21st century. In a post-feminist world, the word wife on its own sounds quaint enough. And good wife conjures up images of blissed out 1950s housewives admiring their hostess trolleys. Good wives are what women had to be before we fought for the right to be good at something else. In 2009, a woman wants to be good at her job, a good mother, a good friend, a good daughter, a good for her age, good in bed, but a good wife? Do me a favour. Still, the defensiveness surrounding the subject of wifely behaviour suggests we're not as sorted out as we like to think we are. The recent throwaway comment by Faye Weldon, an English commentator, about socks, she suggested it might be easier to pick up your husband's socks than to fight about it, ignited a bitter debate about gender stereotypes in relationships. Rewind a few months and Lionel Shriver, we need to talk about Kevin, rattled feminists by creating a fictional character who aspired to marriage. Apparently, even dreaming of lasting love makes some people angry. I'll come back to that one in a moment. There's also a new and flourishing admiration of women such as Michelle Obama, Samantha Cameron and Sarah Brown, who managed to be dutiful wives without compromising their own identity. And somewhere in the middle of all this confusion lies an attitude that could be roughly summed up as, don't you dare try to tell me how to be a good wife. But I don't want to become a divorce stat either. As a married 30-something girlfriend who came close to divorce a year ago says, quote, I don't know about being a good wife, but before I wasn't really being a wife at all. there are things you have to pay attention to in order that the other person feels, well, that it's worth being married at all. Yeah, it is a problem. Two young women have told me of recent times how through high school, both of them in fairly selective schools, how in high school, when it came to careers day, and one of them said it was almost every week at her school, the careers officer would come around and say, well, what is it that you want to be, girls, when you finish school? Here are all the different careers. I've got books on everything. You want to be a doctor? You want to be a lawyer? You want to be a dentist? You want to be... I've got the books on whatever it is. You want to be in retail trade? You want to be in wholesale trade? You want to be a manufacturer? You want to be a politician? Here's the book on this. Here's the course. This is where you go to university. This is what you do. And went around the class asking each of the girls what they wanted to be doing. Give out the books. And each of these two girls I know said, I want to be a wife and mother. Death occurred in the room at that moment. And the careers officer said, we've got no books on that. You've got to choose something else. And they said, but I don't want to choose anything else. That's what I want to be. Well, what are you going to do before you are that? And they said, oh, I don't know, go to university. They said, well, which university? What course do you want to do? I've got books on that. I can show you what to do before you become a wife and mother. But there's nothing on being a wife and mother. Do you really want to be such a thing? Of course, about a third of women still wind up as wives and mothers. It's not kind of an absolute minor career path. It is still the single biggest career path of women in our society. But it is no career path within our education system. It doesn't exist. And when it is suggested, you can be laughed at for suggesting it. The real issue is, what is the sexual diversity within marriage, and what impact does that have on our lives? Are there tasks, are there roles in marriage that are for men, and tasks and roles that are for women? Or is it just the relationship? Should men put out the garbage and women do the washing up? And in the washing up, should the women do the crockery and cutlery and leave the pots and dishes for the men? Nobody seems to me to work harder over a greater range of activities, roles and tasks than the good wife of Proverbs 31. If you want to be exhausted sometime, read what she does. She does everything, inside the home and outside the home. I'm sure that in our day and age it would be written up to include mowing the grass and clipping the children's hair. Marriage is not described in the Bible in terms of tasks and roles, but in terms of relationship. The man and the woman, by covenant, united into a procreative sexual unity. But yet they are not two identical, interchangeable beings. There is a sexual polarity or diversity that is built into the very person and into the relationship between husband and wife. It's not spouse and spouse. It's husband and wife. And these differences are not just in our anatomy. They're not just in our genetic composition, but in the very purposes of God for us and for our well-being. Now, as soon as I talk of differences, we come to the problems of generalisations and individuals and stereotypes. This is a long introduction to what needs to be said tonight, but there's a lot of ground that needs to be cleared away before I'm allowed to say the politically incorrect things I'm about to say. So let me clear away some more rubbish on the ground first. All generalisations, by definition, are not absolutely true, otherwise we'd call them truths. They're called generalisations. They're dealing with relative differences. And there will always be individuals for whom the generalisation does not fit. And so just to be able to say, but I've got an individual here who doesn't fit the norm, does not mean that there isn't a norm. There are 99 people like this. There is one person who is different. The fact that there's one person is different only reinforces the fact that 99 are the same. Generalisations are about the general character of what is the case. Nor does it turn a generalisation into a stereotype. A stereotype is when a generalisation is reduced to an oversimplification by which all people are forced to fit into preconceived ideas. It is said, and I run a risk here and an illustration that I don't want to sink myself on, but it is said that men are better at maths than women and women are better at English than men. The latter everybody agrees upon. It's the former that we're not allowed to say. It's not politically correct, is it? And if you think that men are better at maths than women, you could draw the conclusion, therefore, this woman cannot be better than that man at maths. Well, that's a false deduction from the generalisation. To say that, in general, men are better than women at maths does not say anything about whether this particular man is better than this particular woman. And you could draw from that generalisation, therefore no women should be allowed to have a place at university studying maths. But then that is also an illegitimate conclusion to draw from a generalisation that is true. Well, maybe true. I haven't got enough maths to work it out. The generalisation may or may not be true, but the conclusions are not, that are drawn from that are the stereotypes that we need to avoid. Why does it matter? Well, it comes down to the ethics of difference and discrimination. Sexism gets put into the same moral category as racism. And racism, we're all against. Now, if you want to destroy anybody's political, personal, public, private life, just call them a racist. That is the ultimate taboo word, isn't it? And so if you lump sexism into racism, then by definition you are an immoral, corrupt person to ever suggest that there be any discrimination on the basis of sexuality. But discrimination is not wrong when there is a genuine difference. In fact, not to discriminate is wrong when there is a genuine difference. We should discriminate in favour of young children. You shouldn't treat a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old in the same way in which you treat an adult. You should be protective of them and care for them and be more patient with them. And of course we discriminate in favour of people who are blind. And we should discriminate in favour of our foreigners. Those who are aliens and don't understand our language and our ways should be given some greater degree of latitude and some care and some help. As we should discriminate in favour of elderly people, the more I draw into that generation, the more I'm adamant that this is the case. Discrimination should be in favour of elderly people. And people with disabilities should have favoured benefits given to them. There's nothing wrong with discriminating in favour of people because of their general disadvantage. The fact that some of them do not need discrimination in their favour or do not want discrimination in their favour is quite true, and therefore you don't have to have it, but it doesn't affect the general principle of the rightness of treating people differently in order to treat them the same. I'll give you that. You've got to treat people differently in order to treat them the same. Any parent can tell you of that. Sorry, any sensible parent can tell you that about their children. To treat all the children in an identical fashion is to disadvantage some of the children, because the children are different. Right from day one, you will find your children are different, and you need to treat each one differently in order to treat them fairly. I referred to this matter a few weeks ago, looking at 1 Peter 3, where the woman is called the weaker vessel, and the husband was therefore called upon to treat her differently, to live with her with understanding because of this characteristic of hers. Well, what about marriage and men and women? Here then, briefly, is the biblical view. Our marital duties are firstly that there are conjugal rights. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we are taught that each has the duty to provide for their spouse to satisfy their sexual needs. But this is not a matter of difference. This is a matter of sameness. That is, it is not right for the woman to deny her husband, nor is it right for the man to deny his wife. And so in our weddings, we publicly declare our willingness to enter into sexual relationships, a sexual union like this, so that there can be no claim later that it was a date rape, or that he got me drunk at the time, or that there was forced or unwilling. They and the community, especially the families, hear these promises declared to each other, that they are willing to openly, publicly, without force and coercion, enter into this sexual relationship. And all this concurs with the wish and goodwill of the family and the community. Do not underestimate the real significant importance of weddings. They are very important events in making it perfectly clear to everybody involved that this man and this woman are now united to each other sexually, physically. But then secondly, we come to a dirty word, submission. A word for wives in particular. And nothing gets people's backs up quite so much these days than to hear that a wife is to submit to her husband. In fact, new wedding services do not make any differentiation between the promises given by the husband and the promises given by the wives, as if it's a person marrying a person, instead of a man marrying a woman, instead of a husband marrying a wife. But not only do they leave out references to submit or to obey from the wedding services, but many new wedding services leave out passages like the one we read a few moments ago in Ephesians chapter 5 or another one in Colossians 3 because they refer to submission, and submission is totally unacceptable to our modern community. And so Christians, when Christians marry, will marry in line with what the world is saying rather than with what God is saying in his word. And it's not just the wedding at this point, but the wedding is explicating, is spelling out what our married life is going to be like. At this point, you should be having heresy bells ringing in your head if you are a Christian. For it may be questionable, it is questionable, to adapt our services to fit in with the world, but it is another thing to omit parts of the Bible because it doesn't fit into our world. Give up being Christian if that's the case. Just be the world. What makes us different is we're not living the way the world lives, we live the way God says to live, in his word. If we're not going to read his word when it directly addresses what we should do as husbands and wives, well then we can forget God because we have forgotten him already, haven't we? We've moved well beyond Christian thinking once we omit the Bible's teaching on a subject. So look at submission. It means, the word means, to place yourself under the authority of somebody else. We do not like to do that. You know, in our egalitarian Australian society, we don't like to place ourselves under anybody's authority, and yet we do it all the time without question, without noticing, without objection. It's only when the word submission comes up that we suddenly say, oh, I don't like doing that, but we do it all the time. In fact, our society, and no society, but our society couldn't function if it wasn't for submission. Take a social activity like singing. We were singing this evening. Lovely, beautiful, wonderful singing. Did you notice how much submission it involved for us to make that beautiful music that we did? We submit to the tune. You didn't all choose to sing your own tune, did you? You might say, well, actually, the person behind me was singing their own tune, but we weren't only singing our own tune. We all agreed upon the tune that we would sing. And we agreed in the timing with which we would sing it. And we agreed to be led by our musicians in how we would sing it and the syncopation we would use in the singing of it. All of which involves submitting ourselves to the others, for the common good and for the benefit of ourselves, in fact. I mean, how would it be if everybody sang their own tune to their own rhythm without any references to the leader or the band? That is not a song, that is a cacophony. Society cannot function with everybody doing their own thing. That is not possible. What we do in order to work together is voluntarily submit to one another. Take the policeman in the street. The older I get, the more I perceive the youth of the police. It is an extraordinary thing. I remember being in Bathurst Street many, many years ago when I first saw a policeman that was younger than me. It was a shock to my whole psychological system. I had to sit down and have a long cup of coffee. Now I'm very hard-pressed to meet any policeman who's older than me. The police commissioner is younger than me. It is a strange part of life. But though they have now become all younger than me, and during that lockdown of the city last year, was it, or the year before, when President Bush and the others turned up here, they were getting them straight out of high school, I'm sure. There were 15-year-olds directing the traffic as I walked around. Though they're getting all much younger and younger and younger than me, I still submit to them. When they say stop, you can't go here, I stop. When they say cross now, I cross. When they say, why are you here, sir, I tell them. I submit to them because a policeman has authority over me, appointed by God through the government to that person, irrespective of their age, irrespective of their intelligence, irrespective of their... They are in no way appointed because they are superior to me as human beings. They are appointed because God has appointed them to be in authority over me, and I submit my life to them. That is what I do. That is what I hope you will do. That is what our society must do if our society is going to function. Why, that very policeman who submits to me, should he be a member of the church here, may submit to me as his pastor. I submit to him on the street when he's got his uniform on. He submits to me when I'm his pastor in our church. We submit to one another as is appropriate. What does the New Testament teach us? Well, it teaches us that Jesus submitted to his parents. Think about it, friends. The God of all the universe, who made everything that was, including his parents, he accepted their authority over him and obeyed what they told him to do and submitted to them. There's no sense in which Mary and Joseph were greater than Jesus. They were the creatures. He was the creator. And yet, he submitted himself to them because they were his parents. And God says we should honour our mother and our father. So come with me to Ephesians chapter 5. If you haven't got it open, it's page 1177. Where we're taught that the wise way to walk as Christians is by being filled with the Spirit. And the way of life for those who are filled with the Spirit is, verse 19, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with all your heart, giving thanks always and for everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. The outcome of your submission, of being filled with the Spirit, is you will have four things, four participles: addressing one another, making melody to the Lord, giving thanks to God the Father, and submitting to one another. This is the Christian Spirit-filled walk. That the non-Christians don't get it should not surprise you, because they are not filled with the Spirit of God. But if you're filled with the Spirit of God, then you should be different. And your area of difference will be in addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. I don't expect non-Christians to do that. In making melody to the Lord with all your heart, I don't expect non-Christians to do that. Giving thanks to God the Father for everything, I don't expect non-Christians to do that. And submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ, I don't expect non-Christians to do that either. But I do expect Christians to do all four things. For that is the Spirit-filled life of Christians. And that submitting to one another is then spelt out in the next passage, where three sets of relationships are described. Wives to their husbands, verse 22, wives submit to your husbands as to the Lord. That is, it says, not to all husbands, but to your own husband. Children to their parents in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. And then slaves to masters in chapter 6, verses 5 to 9. This is the way for wives, Christian wives, to live with their husbands. Notice it does not say, husbands, please careful note here, girls, you can fall asleep for a moment if you like, you won't of course, but you can. But men, it does not say, husbands, subjugate your wives. It's addressed to wives. Wives, submit yourself to your husband. Submission must be voluntary for it to be submission. Wives, submit yourself to your own husbands. It's the willing gift of the wife to her husband. Notice that she is given the example of the church submitting to Christ. in everything she's told in verse 24, and the passage concludes in verse 33, to respect, that is the word fear, your husband. Stand in awe of him. Thirdly, notice that she is also told of the structure of the relationship. Her husband is her head as Christ is the head of the church. I mean, we have a head of state, not sure who it is, whether it's the Queen, the Governor General, the President or the Prime Minister, but we have one. Everyone has a head of state. Well, the head of every woman is her husband. Now, friends, I've spoken at length at this in submission in a chat room that you can get the download from our website or from philipjensen.com. At an Easter convention a couple of years ago, we gave a long talk on the subject of submission. And it's a word that keeps returning to us in the Bible, and the Bible teaches it, and we mustn't run away from it. We've got to discover what it means and discover how to put it into effect in our lives, dear sisters. But if marriage raises the dirty word of submission, it also raises the dirty task for men, the dirty task of love. Now, of course, besotted by romantic love, most people don't feel this is much of a dirty task, and they'd say, well, I'd much prefer to love than to submit. That's because they haven't studied love yet. Love is a dirty job. So verse 25, husbands are to love their wives. And notice the way in which you are to love your wives in verse 25, as Christ loved the church. And in case you don't see the implications of this, Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. This is the dirty task that many modern men are not willing to undertake. To put aside all self-interest and to live, and yes, to die for the sake of your wife. I mean, it's still there in our community, though, whether it's a hangover from the days of Christian culture or whether it is a matter of innate to men, I don't know. But if you remember the Port Arthur massacre back in the 1990s, 1998 I think it was, the description of the deaths showed that over and over again, men shielding women from the bullets. The kind of only variation to that was the mother who was shielding her three, I think, little children. Women will shield their children, men will shield their women. But Jesus was not just caught up in the moment of crisis. He intentionally gave his life for the church. He intentionally went to Jerusalem to be crucified. No one went to Port Arthur to be shot. But Jesus went to Jerusalem to be crucified for us. I mean, doing the right thing at the moment of extremity in courage, I think is easier, frankly, than day in, day out, hour in, hour out, year in, year out, to put yourself out for the sake of your wife, to consistently and consciously go to work year after year, to boring work, to work you don't enjoy, but work which will enable you to care and provide for your wife as she raises your children. That is real love. That is devotion. That is responsibility. And our aim, brothers, is to be like Christ, laying down our lives for our wives, presenting the church to himself, as he says it there in verses chapter 5, verse 27, 28, presenting the church to himself, pure and spotless, holy and without blemish on the day of judgment. That is what a husband should be doing. That's what a Christian husband does. He lives and dies for his wife's salvation. He lives and dies for his wife's holiness. That's why the husband is the pastor of the wife. Unmarried sisters who are here with us this night, do you see why you cannot, why you must not marry a non-Christian man? For no non-Christian man will ever lay down his life so that you will be pure and spotless before Christ on the last day. He is unable to live for your salvation and for your holiness. He has to be an unacceptable and unsuitable man for you to marry. For the very heart of what he is doing as your husband in presenting you pure and spotless before Christ, he can't do. Therefore, he is totally unsuitable. If you're in a relationship with him now, already, then break off that relationship with him immediately, because you're not doing him any kindness, any love, to continue misleading him into thinking that he would be a suitable husband for you. Men, do you see, unmarried men especially, do you see why you cannot enter into short-term sexual relationships? And you cannot enter into de facto relationships? Or ever use or abuse a woman sexually?
or fail to take responsibility seriously to provide for a sister. I mean, there can be reasons for men not marrying and for remaining single. They're there for us in 1 Corinthians 7. But the default position is that we will marry and raise children. And to this task, we will put aside all other tasks. We will govern everything else we're doing. This is our chief task, in a sense, in this world, to be fruitful, to fill the earth, to multiply. As we garden, as we care for this world that is God's, so we care for the woman that God has given to us to look after, to serve, to lay our life down for as a sacrifice. And we will not enter into marriage half-heartedly, you know, with a prenuptial agreement, which is a kind of recipe for saying it's going to go wrong anyway, and seek to save money and get as much out. When we marry by the prayer book, and there the husband is completely different to the wife gives nothing to her husband, and the husband gives all his worldly goods to her. So that when they separate, she gets the lot, and you get nothing. Whereas in modern services, he gives his, she gives hers. They have it as a kind of joint account, or maybe 50-50, and keep separate accounts in case they divide down the track. And when they do break up, they try and divide the assets down the middle. Rubbish, men. If you take a wife, then you give your life. And all that's yours is hers. And all that's hers is hers. For she has given herself to you. That's what's happened. It's equitable, but it is not interchangeable. The man is the man and the woman is the woman. They're a husband and wife. And what about those of us who are outside of marriage? Well, you don't suddenly become a man or suddenly become a woman by getting married. And we are to learn to grow as men and as women in our life, and we are to treat our brothers and sisters in ways that will reflect Christian masculinity and Christian femininity. Not men insisting on being treated like men, but men insisting on being men by serving our sisters. For Christian masculinity, Christian manliness, is to serve responsibly without being asked to. It's to lead in prayer in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 8. And what about femininity? We do not have to submit to every man, my sisters, as if every man were our husband. But yet we should so treat men that we will encourage them to be good husbands and to learn their responsibility to do the dirty work that marriage is calling them to lay down their life for the salvation of their bride, as Christ laid down his life for the salvation of his bride. And so make sure that as you treat your brothers, you treat them in a way that will encourage them in this spiritual masculinity.